We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order.
This is Multipolarity, charting the rise of the new multipolar world order.
Coming up this week,
NVIDIA has become a stock market behemoth on the back of their AI-friendly graphics chips. Last week saw them hit a $2.19 trillion market capitalization. So are they the future of the globe's most info-critical resource, or a sign that we're entering the pets.com era of the AI age?
Meanwhile, after months of delays and diplomatic blocking operations, Sweden and Finland are officially in NATO. But with past and future President Trump signaling that he will be less interested in European defense, are they arriving at a party just as the lights go up?
Finally, British equities used to be 9% of the global equity market. New data confirms that they're now just 3%. And the trend line is south. As the city's long-term future gently slides out of view, Britain is going to need a new basket for all its eggs. Is the London banker bubble about to burst?
But first,
machine learning difficulties.
The stock price of NVIDIA, the erstwhile maker of graphics cards for gamers, has gone absolutely gangbusters. It looks real kind of stock of the year stuff. Probably beyond that, it looks more like kind of 2000s era tech bubble pets.com stuff. Okay, we'll get back to that. It's not a pets.com. It's not a completely fake company. But, you know, the stock price movement, it's so bonkers at this stage that even the kind of usually pretty placid finance Twitter, who doesn't like to make bullish noises as a collective swarm, doesn't like to make, bearish noises, is actually making kind of bearish noises and making fun of the extent to which the stock market, the Nvidia stock has rallied. Just to give some sense, I saw in Bloomberg last week, it kind of told the story better than anything else, that in terms of its market capitalization, that is kind of like the prices of stocks times the amount of stocks, basically company valuation. In terms of its market cap, Nvidia has increased more than the vast majority of large companies. So just to give some sense, Berkshire Hathaway, which is Warren Buffett's outfit, which is a firm that runs, that owns a bunch of other firms, the Nvidia market cap increase is larger than the entire market cap of Berkshire Hathaway. The increase in the Nvidia market cap is just shy of the entire market cap of Meta, Facebook. So this has gone absolutely bonkers. Just to give some sense of how much the stock has gone up, it's gone up about 50% in the last 6 months, about 225% in the last year, and an insane 1,600% in the past 5 years. So what's happening here? Well, I'd say, again, our listeners probably know that this has to do with the AI boom. As I said, Nvidia used to be a kind of humble producer of computer graphics cards. And while the computer graphics cards market is important, it's not generally seen as a very high growth market. The number of gamers has, you know, limits. And so, you know, it used to be kind of an industry that would just chug on, like talcum powder or nappies. But the AI boom has led to a new use for these graphics cards or the technology behind them. Because basically the AI learning systems use very similar types of processors or chips or whatever as the graphics cards. The technology is pretty much the same. So Nvidia made a very wise move to say, well, we make this kind of technology anyway, we're gonna go in this AI direction. So this isn't, although some of the skepticism around the increase in Nvidia's stock price is probably justified, it's probably gone up too much and it's probably too volatile, to be honest. It's not totally fake like pets.com, where there was no underlying business underneath the valuation itself. There is a change here. It's this switch to AI, and Nvidia is making money out of that. Real money, not fake money. It is selling these chips en masse to the big Silicon Valley companies. The big buyers for Nvidia's chips are Amazon, Microsoft, Google or Alphabet, Meta, Facebook, and Dell. So these big giants are buying huge amounts of chips from NVIDIA, and that's boosting their earnings revenue, and the stock market is reacting to that. So in that sense, again, it's not a pets.com. It's not kind of a speculative business. Real cash is changing hands for these chips, and the markets are trying to price that in. And you see that, for example, if you look at a valuation metric like price to sales, hasn't really gone gangbusters for NVIDIA, which is what would have happened if this was all speculative. So the revenues have gone up and the stock price is chasing it. The question really, and we can talk about it a little more in a moment, is whether this whole AI boom is for real. AI is definitely exists. Most people that are listening have probably played with ChatGPT. But the question is it going to deliver on its promises? That's really the underlying thing here. There may be some overshooting of NVIDIA, and that's why, you know, as I said, the usually bullish financial Twitter is making slightly bearish noises, because there could be a little bit of an overreaction here. But the real question for NVIDIA as a company moving forward, and whether it can maintain this revenue growth, is if the AI boom is a real thing. And if it turns out to be mostly hype, then NVIDIA's fortunes will probably fall, as will their revenues.
When this story first hit the mainstream news headlines, I did a little bit of research into it because I almost couldn't believe the extent to which it had grown. And I stumbled upon an article on a really excellent markets blog called wolfstreet.com. It did seem to a certain degree that there was some underlying fundamentals behind the stock market growth. You know, NVIDIA's revenues might hit $100 billion in 2024 this year, up from only $27 billion in 2022. And it is, in fact, the case that those companies that you mentioned are plowing huge amounts of money into AI. And that means, essentially, in the current market, buying vast quantities of NVIDIA chips. The real issue is whether, I guess, and you know better than me, you know more about the stock market than me, if the growth in NVIDIA prices is really essentially pricing in a far greater expansion in NVIDIA revenues and its market position than is realistically on the cards. One of the points that this Wall Street article made was that, yeah, we've been here before with NVIDIA. Between the end of 2021 and the kind of the back end of 2022, NVIDIA prices dropped by 65%, basically kind of, you know, imploding as a stock. I mean, that's a huge chunk of market capitalization. And the question is, if, you know, one of these big companies who's buying huge quantities of NVIDIA chips decides that, you know, the AI course that they're on is a bad bet, or they decide to, shift to another manufacturer because they feel they can get, you know, similar performance for less money, or somebody else steps into the breach. Again, you could get a huge reduction. And, you know, the other point is, for instance, NVIDIA's revenues still haven't, you know, matched Tesla's, for example. Okay. And Tesla is also a company that lost 60-70% from its peak in early 2022, back end of 2021. And it still hasn't recovered anywhere near that amount. So it does seem that these stocks, you know, go for a wild ride as investors price in massive potential earnings, essentially, and make bets that those earnings are going to come. I wonder, though, I mean, how much of this, Philip, might be one of those kind of classic stock market blow-offs where the smart money gets involved, you know, realizes that in this case, let's make a hypothetical scenario here. The smart money got involved because it saw everybody was plowing money into AI. It's the kind of the next big thing. They all needed these kind of machine learning processes. And they realized that they were going to have to buy from NVIDIA these GPUs, which run these machine learning processes. So the smart money got involved, drove up the price, and then your average kind of retail investor who doesn't sit in a corner office in Canary Wharf or on Wall Street and doesn't have an army of 15 Chinese and Indian mathematics wizards, all these kind of retail investors got involved, and that's driving the stock price up. And, you know, is it one of those cases where we're on the cusp of seeing a big blow off and plunge? I mean, is that what's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, I get the sense we're where you say we are. I mean, once the guy on the street is talking about a stock, it's usually overbought. I actually had lunch with a friend of mine who runs a pretty big equity fund the other day, and I asked him what was in his portfolio, and he was telling me about the stocks, and he kind of smirked and said, you know, a lot of my clients are calling me up and trying to get me to buy Nvidia. So that's kind of when you know it's a little bit overbought, when the people who pay you to manage their money start coming up with suggestions themselves. So man in the street is interested in Nvidia, therefore Nvidia is very likely overbought. That generally is how these things work. Now, I think much more interesting than the short-term volatility in the stock or the excitement or the bubble or whatever you want to call it, I think more interesting is whether this AI revolution is all it's cracked up to be. And look, nobody can really tell because, you know, we kind of get what the technology is. I mean, I have a pretty good understanding of artificial intelligence. I worked with it in finance years ago, probably one of the earlier people to have seen the technology. You know, I understand how it works, and we'll go into that maybe in a moment. But we don't know the applications until it's tried. Like, nobody could have the foresight to see the applications all at once, you know, because every little silo doing something that AI could be useful for, you'll only understand how it's useful if you're in that silo. But the issue with it is, to my mind, and why I think it's a little overboard in terms of an idea, is that AI, it's not really a new technology. And that's what people have been kind of kidded with here. It's kind of marketing hype, this AI. Now, that doesn't mean that this powerful new pattern recognition technology won't be consequential. But people are being sort of fooled by marketing rhetoric when they're told that it's new. And the term artificial intelligence in particular, while very clever from a marketing point of view because it makes people dive into all sorts of metaphysical debates about what it means to think, and you get free advertising when they do so, it is not intelligence in any sense of the word. It just simply is not intelligence. It does not replicate anything resembling human intelligence. It's pattern recognition, and it works through statistical correlations. Statistical correlations were invented in the late 19th century, I want to say, mainly by a British mathematician called Carl Pearson, after which, if you've worked with stats, you'll know that the simple correlation, or Pearson statistic, is named after Carl Pearson. And it's pretty much that. If you've ever seen people run correlations, whether they be in epidemiological studies, in medical testing, very famously in econometrics. Econometrics, I think, is probably the most advanced discipline to use these statistical tests. And those tests are often usually borrowed by other fields after being developed by econometricians. And what correlations do is pretty simple. You take data and you correlate it to each other, and you hope by doing so to understand something further about the data, usually whether something causes something else. So if we say, you know, wages are correlated with inflation, you can make the argument that either inflation causes wages to increase, or wage increases cause inflation. Now, you can't 100% tell. All you have is this correlation, but you know, you can use your intuition and so on. So that's all it is. It's just running of correlations. And the reason I think that it'll end up having quite much more limited use than what people think is because of the limits of correlation analysis itself. If you've ever run statistical analyses, you'll know, anyone who's good at it knows, that it's actually a lot more limited than people think. If somebody comes up to you and says, I'm a statistician or an econometrician and I can do anything with this sort of analysis, I'm so good at it that I can figure out anything for you, I can make your business run better, blah, 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 they're probably not very good at it. The people who are good at it know its limitations, and the limitations are pretty simple, because sometimes correlations are just a coincidence, right? Sometimes it's just a coincidence that the two time series move together with each other. I remember my boss in finance used to have this great chart which showed that that the quantities of cheese eaten every year correlated really well with people who die by getting wrapped up in their own bedsheets. And of course, there's no connection between those two events, but the data just happened to correlate. And that happens a lot. And the issue is that when you kind of make, usually when a human being is standing there coming up with a kind of a hypothesis, which the hypothesis has some sort of logic behind it, like wages and inflation, and then they can test that hypothesis using correlation analysis. That's how you use correlation analysis. If you set a computer on autopilot to find patterns and to find correlations, they'll probably find stuff that doesn't mean that much. Now, that's great from the point of view of, for example, when you turn your iPhone over and it recognizes your face. That's really good. That technology, AI technology, is really good for pattern recognition like that. But the idea that it can massively increase our capacity to understand the world, for example, and related to that, that it can massively increase businesses or the economy's capacity to process information, I'm quite skeptical of. I think it'll end up having pretty good applications, but I don't think it'll be that consequential. And the idea that AI is going to be more consequential than, for example, the internet, the Google search engine, the rise of the personal computer, I don't buy that. Those seem like much, much bigger technological developments to me. And frankly, we've had those developments now since probably the 1990s. We had personal computing revolution, then we had the internet, and then, you know, really good access to search engines and, of course, online shopping. And while they have changed the world, they haven't really changed the economy in this kind of fundamental way where you're talking about another fourth industrial revolution. Not really. We're still working in offices. We can just process information a little bit faster.
Even if AI does turn out to be as consequential as perhaps some of its boosters believe for the business world, that doesn't necessarily mean that NVIDIA is going to take a monopolistic position in the market, or in fact, some of the potential sales that perhaps the folks driving up the share price envisage are actually going to happen. The article that I referenced earlier in this podcast did mention that it's not so long ago that Meta, which runs Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp, suddenly realized that it had far too many staff. You know, it could run the company on like much less staff, not like trimming 5% here and there, but like, you know, trimming half of them. And therefore, it needed much less office space. And a whole bunch of other companies in a similar field reached the same conclusion. And therefore, the value of office space in the sort of areas that they inhabited, you know, wasn't so high or sought after anymore. And it's quite possible to envisage a company like Meta saying, like, look, we've been buying like vast quantities of these NVIDIA GPUs for kind of a few years now to invest in our AI. You know, we have a whole bunch of them, which are kind of more than powerful enough to run the machine learning runs that we need. And we just need to buy, you know, like a few more every year now to supplement this. It's possible to imagine something like this. And I think it also bears considering that since this is multipolarity, there's a geostrategic matter at play here. We've already seen that US sanctions on Chinese access to high-end chips has stimulated an extremely well-funded effort within China to produce its own CPUs and, one guesses as well, GPUs. And they seem to be making progress at an astonishing speed. I was reading about a recent camera phone that was designed very much with photography in mind, and therefore it was a collaboration with Leica. But the chipset that was run with was kind of really high end. I think it was, you know, like 4 or 5 nanometers or something like that. And it made me realize, like, wow, these guys are rolling out their own kind of chips at an incredible speed. And it's not beyond the realms of possibility that somebody like NVIDIA or NVIDIA itself, I should say, could within 10 years have a Chinese competitor. Is it really beyond the realms of possibility that China at the moment is thinking to itself, like, we can't rely on access to any of these chips, we need to develop our own? It's certainly the case that China is ahead in other areas of the fourth industrial revolution that you mentioned, like 5G. I saw an amazing video presentation about a Chinese factory that has heavily integrated local networks with 5G. And yeah, it essentially runs itself in the dark. It doesn't even need lighting. And it's, you know, really an incredible thing. So, you know, if AI and machine learning and pattern recognition is going to be important to that, one would have thought that the Chinese get involved. So there could indeed as well be a geostrategic aspect to this as well. There are lots of potential cracks there for an overstretched market. The idea that, you know, maybe these companies that are buying lots of them won't. The idea that maybe China will get involved in the market, or in fact, the idea that the promise of AI doesn't quite meet the expectations that we've perhaps been led to by people who think it'll be revolutionary.
Don't hate the NATO.
Listeners will be aware that Sweden has finally joined NATO. It acceded officially to NATO last week. Both Sweden and Finland applied to join NATO in the aftermath of Russian war in Ukraine. And they argued that now was the time to join NATO as a matter of defensive protection. However, two countries specifically, Hungary and Turkey, had reservations about that. Finland managed to overcome those reservations very quickly. However, for Sweden, it was a much longer process. Turkey argued that it was harboring several members of a group, or a Kurdish group, which Turkey views as a terrorist organization. In the past, Sweden has viewed these people as reasonable asylum seekers. And in order to get over Turkey's objections, it had to deport several people. It had to change certain laws. But eventually it did. And that left Hungary on its own. And eventually Hungary, you know, passed a measure through parliament to agree to Sweden's accession to NATO. This is being presented, the accession of Finland and Sweden is being presented as a major coup for the Western alliance on several levels. I don't think it is, really. I think, in fact, that it's a complete nothing burger. I think that people should realize that Sweden and Finland were pretty heavily integrated into the Western alliance anyway. During the Cold War, it was a slightly different situation with Finland because of the history of the Winter War in the late 1930s and the influence that the Soviet Union maintained over Finland and the neutrality that involved. The same with Sweden, was a neutral country, but Sweden especially was, during the Cold War, you know, quite surprisingly more involved with, you know, NATO and Western intelligence than it is perhaps given credit for. During the Cold War, it also had quite a formidable defense industry and a formidable armed forces country of its size. None of that has changed since the end of the Cold War. In fact, it's continued. I believe I'm right in saying that both Finland and Sweden, even before the Ukraine situation, did indeed regularly engage in exercises with NATO forces. And these exercises are ultimately with a view to fostering interoperability during any for any kind of you know, military needs. The other argument is that it makes essentially the Baltic a NATO lake. Well, yeah, I mean, so what? You know, as I said, you know, Finland and Sweden were both very much in the Western camp. You know, it's not as if Finland and Sweden were kind of like Belarus or something and suddenly they're switching over to being NATO members. No, they were very much in the NATO camp. Secondly, you know, the Baltic and the Finnish Gulf, which kind of leads into St. Petersburg, which is where a great deal of Russian trade exits. It's a, you know, it's a warm weather port. It's a big city. It's a big port. Even, you know, even then, you know, it's close enough to existing NATO members, the Baltic states, for, you know, NATO, if they could, in theory, to, you know, to close that. But even so, they've got the Denmark Straits. You know, if anybody looks on a map, you know, they'll see is, you know, once you leave the Baltic, you essentially get to Denmark. And those quite large islands between Denmark and Sweden, over which there's a bridge now, and boats have to navigate quite narrow channels to get through there. It's a maritime choke point. It always has been for Russia. So I'm not sure that changes much. I think Finland has more of an effect on Russia strategically than Sweden. And the reason I believe that is because Russian killer submarines, or let's just say the home port of the Northern Fleet, is in Murmansk, which is on the Kola Peninsula in the far north of Russia, kind of nearish the Norwegian border. And there's a single road essentially leading north there, and it's not so far away from the Finnish border. So in theory, NATO could interdict that road and give the Russians a real logistical nightmare. But I'm not sure that really, you know, especially since NATO prides itself on being a defensive-only alliance, I'm not sure that that is, like, such a big deal. It certainly shouldn't justify some of the talk of a great blow to Russia that this is involved. And ultimately, I think everybody is kind of happy to a certain degree with this. And I'll tell you why. First of all, it's a PR. It plays into the narrative of dealing a blow to Russia in the same way that sanctions did. Sanctions didn't really. We spoke about this extensively on the project, on the podcast. Sanctions haven't had anywhere near the effect that they were suggested to have, and Russia and the Russian economy is growing faster than any in Western Europe at the moment. And in the same way, I think, you know, Swedish and Finnish accession, it's a narrative, it's a PR victory as much as anything. I think the Swedish and Finnish governments will be happy because a lot of Western governments now have bought into the idea of kind of stakeholder democracy and internationalism in terms of the way that they manage their affairs. Popularism in the Western world is a direct response to that. We've again spoke about this on the podcast, but you know, the fear and panic perhaps, or the outrage perhaps, in the Finnish and Swedish populations in the aftermath of Russian forces moving over the border into Ukraine was perhaps an opportunity for folks in Finland and Sweden to join NATO. So they're probably happy as well. The rest of the West is happy because they've got a PR boost, but I'm not sure it does anything. In fact, despite what I've read online on Twitter, some Swedes saying, well, it will help us defend Gotland, which is an island in the Baltic. I'm not sure the Russians have great designs on Gotland. Even if they did, they really ought to read the precise wording of Article 5, the famous Article 5 of NATO, which leaves NATO member states rather more leeway than perhaps is widely understood in terms of the way that they respond to any attacks. But I think it's generally bad. Sweden and Finland, Stockholm and Helsinki, were not targeted by nuclear weapons a few months ago. They are now. You know, it also means that, you know, the next time the US wants to go on an adventure to, say, Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever, Swedish and Finnish troops, and Sweden and Finland more generally, will be under pressure, will be under great diplomatic pressure to get involved in said adventures. And ultimately, I'm not sure it's too much of a blow to Russia, because Sweden and Finland were already in the Western camp. Sweden and Finland were already, to a certain degree, integrated. The only difference is now there's going to be more American troops there. Well, okay. But that's the way I see it. I think it's a nothing burger. I think it's probably ultimately strategically bad for Sweden and Finland. But you know, the folks who run that country get to lock them further into the international superstructure that they prefer, and Western countries get to be a bit of a PR victory.
Yeah, I mean, the two things in addition to that, I'd say I share your skepticism. The first is that Sweden and Finland are joining a club that is not clearly going to exist for the next few years. It may, but, you know, like Donald Trump, who's the front runner in the US, is making noise that he's saying we won't defend Europe anymore if, you know, you guys have to pay for your own defense. Well, that's pretty much saying NATO's bust, you know, without the money coming into Europe. I mean, the money in the form of, you know, US military and so on, and the umbrella that exists, the nuclear and military umbrella that exists under the NATO treaty. NATO doesn't really exist. I mean, you could still have meetings, I guess. You could still have kind of like NATO summits. But if America isn't really saying that they're going to provide defense umbrella for you, then to my mind, NATO doesn't really exist. So it's a kind of a strange time to join it. You usually would, you know, it's the smart politics usually is to join a project when it seems to be on the up and up, you know, like joining the European Union or the European Trade Organization. I can't remember the name of it. Was it the Coal and Steel Union at that point? I can't remember. In the 1970s was probably a pretty good bet. I mean, you know, there's Eurosceptics and everything, but if you believe in the European project, that's when to get in. Like, you shouldn't really be joining organizations when they're going through an extreme rocky period and may even cease to exist. So that's the first point to make. The second point is, I think actually if you drill into the story around Hungary being the last to approve NATO, you actually get an even more interesting sense of the, frankly, the fragility of the organization. So the rationale for Hungary blocking Sweden's bid has not been widely reported in Western media because a lot of the Western press is very liberal and doesn't like Viktor Orban. But they were blocking it because the Swedes had raised issues with Hungary's human rights record. Effectively, they were saying, you guys are violating international human rights laws by being, you know, nasty to LGBT people within your country. Hungary made the, I think, reasonably sensible point that you're asking to come into an organization where we commit young Hungarian men to die on your soil to defend it, and you pretty much go around, you know, saying that we are human rights violators. We need to have some friendship within the alliance if we want to take the alliance seriously. That's ultimately why Budapest blocked it until the Swedish Prime Minister went to Budapest and made a symbolic gesture, I guess, of friendship. The reason I highlight that is, well, for one, it wasn't properly reported, but for another, you know, at a more fundamental level, it speaks to the NATO project itself. There's a lot of fragmentation within the alliance structure. I mean, you know, I've just talked about Hungary and Sweden. They can probably bury the hatchet fine. But, you know, Turkey is in NATO, and Turkey isn't, you know, the most comfortable member of NATO, shall we say. They're not looking to leave, as far as I know. But there's internal tensions within it. And NATO has expanded so much since its original inception that it's pulled in all these countries with differing interests and so on. Obviously, the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, so the threat that NATO is protecting against is less clear. Some people will say the Ukraine war shows that Russia is kind of a reformed Soviet Union, and therefore, you know, we've all heard the arguments some people can make of them what they will. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that there isn't really a clearly defined enemy, and the coherence of the entity itself, even without considering the fact that the US seemed to be getting sick of it, or at least one side of the aisle seems to be getting sick of it, the tensions within the alliance themselves would raise some questions too.
I think that's a really important point, and to distill it a little bit, such alliances and military alliances in general work best when they're very tightly defined. And they spend as much time thinking who to exclude as to who to bring in. What do I mean by that? Well, such military alliances work because of the credible threat that more than one country would get involved to protect another. And that country would get involved to protect another. The more diverse the national interests involved, the more diverse the political cultures, the greater conflict within that military alliance, the less credible that threat becomes, right? And you made exactly that point with regard to Sweden and Hungary. Hungary made an extremely good point. Like, look, how can we commit to defend Sweden? How could we commit to defend the island of Gotland in the Baltic, which seems a big deal to Swedes? Of course it does. It's sovereign Swedish territory. But does that really seem like a big deal to Hungary? Now, that might work if Sweden and Hungary were kind of locked at the hip and were best friends. But the fact is they haven't been. Sweden has been a leader in its criticism of Viktor Orban's government and the way that he runs Hungary, despite his huge and overwhelming democratic mandates over the last decade. That happens the same with Turkey and Sweden. Sweden had to, you know, really changed the way it deals with migrants and asylum seekers in order to placate Turkey. So as it expands and as its membership grows and grows more disparate, more fragmented, then the very credibility of the defensive commitment itself starts breaking up. And that's before we get to the point of, well, what does NATO get involved in and what does it do? I don't think anybody who is reasonable expects, Russia to, be marching into Paris anytime soon. So what does it do? I mean, do the Swedes, who have prided themselves on being neutral and a humanitarian superpower for decades now, so long that it's ingrained in their mentality, would they really feel comfortable joining a coalition of the willing to remove a Middle Eastern dictator, for example? That's a good question. And if they're not, then what worth is NATO? These are all really important questions. So I think that it, very much could be a case of kind of classic case of imperial overreach. But certainly this isn't the great victory that it's being made out to be in the press. And even insofar as it kind of, hems Russia into the Baltic. No, not really. They were already hemmed in through the Denmark Strait, and Finland and Sweden were already fairly highly integrated with the Western defensive alliance. Playing footsie with disaster.
So Bloomberg columnist John Authors, who's a good read, he has a daily chart dump kind of thing in your email inbox if you want it, ran a few charts on the UK exit on his Bloomberg column last week, which I thought were very interesting because they showed that international investors, and actually kind of investors generally, British investors included, are really falling out of love with Britain. Just to give some sense of this, I think we kind of should be looking at this from the point of view of when Britain became a heavily financialized economy, which was effectively between 1983 and 1986, when the so-called Big Bang took place, when the Thatcher government deregulated its capital markets and allowed for this enormous flourishing of finance in the City of London. Well, shortly after the Big Bang in the 90s, the sort of the boom years where we had Britpop and so on, a booming Britain as it was then, I vaguely remember it. In the 90s, UK equities market cap made up about 9% of global markets. So, a tenth of global markets was taken up with the UK equities market. That's not bad for a mid-sized country like Britain. It was definitely punching above its weight. And, this was part of the entire financial model that Britain adopted. First under Thatcher, she laid the groundwork for it, and then especially embraced by Tony Blair. Well, today, that is not the case anymore. Today, UK equities only make up 3% of the global market. So it's dropped from 9% to 3%. So that is dismal. And that's not actually, I've looked into it slightly. You could think, that's because the capital markets in China and India have taken off and made up a much bigger share and shrank the overall Western share. That's not really the case if you look at it. This really is just a decline in Britain's share. So what's driven the decline? Well, if you look at, for example, trade between Britain and the EU, it hasn't really changed that much with the Brexit vote. But Brexit has had two effects. One of the effects has been that just after the vote, sterling repriced. It fell by about, 15 or 20%, and it's never recovered since. And that hit British living standards because import prices were driven up. The other hit is British equities. There is pretty clear evidence, if you look at this chart, that British equities go from about 6% of the global market. So they'd already fallen since the 90s. They'd started falling after 2008. But they'd already fallen to about 6%, and they go right down to 3% after the Brexit vote. The additional thing that's happened more recently, so that's obviously back 2015, 2016, when they start to fall, but until recently, until the pandemic in 2020, British equities, although they were a smaller share of the overall market, they were still valued in reasonably the same way. So valuations, that is kind of like the price of the equities relative to the underlying companies, the earnings of the underlying companies, for example, in Britain, kind of tracked valuations in America. And what that basically tells you, equity investors, stock investors, had the same confidence in British markets as they had in American markets. That is no longer the case. That has not been the case since 2020. Currently, the British FTSE 100 index is trading at about half the valuation of the S&P 500. So investors are effectively looking forward in the at these British companies and looking out at their prospects in the future, and they are about half as confident in them as in the American stocks. Of course, that some will say that means British valuations are cheap, and they are, in a sense, cheap. But this is indicative of a general sense of pessimism about the British markets. Now, look, in another country, this wouldn't matter that much. If I was looking at the German DAX back in the day, okay, before deindustrialization started, I would have said, you know, it doesn't really matter what the DAX does. Ultimately, Germany's an industrial economy. It lives and dies on its export revenues. You know, you could say the same about China. Often people point to the Chinese market and there's chaos in it because it's a bit of a wild ride, the Chinese market, and the valuations of their stocks are strange. And they point to that, to China, and they say, oh, look, it's a wreck or whatever. And I say, I don't care. It doesn't really matter. The market doesn't really matter as much as the underlying manufacturing. The same is true in Japan. Japanese markets have been very strange since about 1990. And yet the underlying economy, although it has serious demographic problems, is still a big export powerhouse. Again, until the energy price costs started to deindustrialize it recently. But Britain is different. As I said earlier, after the Big Bang, Britain became incredibly reliant on its finance sector. And I think we've spoken about this on the podcast before. Basically, Britain runs a very, very large trade deficit or current account deficit. And this means that Britain imports a lot more than it exports. And it does that because its industry has pretty much been eviscerated. British industry now makes up less than 9% of GDP. American, I think, is still around 16% or something like that. So it's British industry has been eviscerated. I think everybody knows this. And so the country imports much more than it exports. It plugs that gap. It finances that trade deficit. And therefore, it finances British living standards through capital coming into the City of London. Now, less capital is coming into the City of London already. We know that because the equity markets don't make us up as large as a share. But by hook or by crook, we still seem able to pull in enough to fund the current account. My concern is that these metrics that we're talking about on the show today are a canary in the coal mine. And that if and when we have another recession and stock markets tank again and all the markets tank as we get, you know, it's a cyclical game. When that happens, I think we're going to see a massive shakeout in the City of London. I think that these are forward-looking indicators, canaries in the coal mine, saying, the financial markets are saying, Britain, we're not as interested in your financialized economy anymore. And if I'm correct about that, the next recession slash financial crisis slash whatever it is will result in a substantial decline in British living standards that the country will not quickly recover from. By not quickly recover from, I mean won't recover from unless policy changes or the economy changes in such a way to recover the economy without trying to fall back on this financialized model that no longer works.
Yeah, this is something that I've actually been really quite concerned with for a long time now. It's something I've been petrified about, in fact, in terms of Britain's ability to maintain its living standards and even maintain what's left of its standing in the world. You know, as you quite rightly alluded to, after the 1970s, throughout the 80s, and then really accelerated, surprisingly enough, under the Labour government of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, Britain deindustrialized really quite significantly. And the idea was, the logic of that was from the prevailing economic theorists of the time, that look, Britain's competitive advantage in the world, Britain's kind of Ricardian advantage in the world, is financial services and the service sector in general. And therefore, this is what we should concentrate on. We shouldn't worry about those things which we don't have a competitive advantage in. And in fact, everybody would live better if, you know, we did the financial services and the Germans did the cars and the, you know, that's how it would work in general. The issue is that the British economy, for those who don't know, Britain really has verging on kind of third world levels of regional inequality. The difference between London and the southeast, London is located in the southeast of Britain for our American listeners. So the difference between London and the southeast of England and the rest of the UK is it's like really astonishing. It's almost like two different countries, where London is, you know, one of the wealthiest places in the world, you know, certainly up there with the wealthier areas in places like Germany and the United States, but the rest of the UK is kind of like poorer than the poorest state in the US. We discussed this on a previous podcast. People should listen to that because it's really quite stark. Now, if the city of London starts degrading in any way, then that could have really quite serious effects. You outlined some of the economic side of that, you know, having to close our current account deficit. And the way that we would close it is essentially through much lower living standards overall. But I just want to put that into concrete terms. If people lost confidence in the city of London, or if the city of London became just another European financial sector, still quite decent in size, like, say, you know, like Paris or Madrid or something like that, but not the city of London, i.e. kind of world-leading financial hub on a similar level to Singapore, Tokyo, and the United and New York, then we would have a real problem. And you might find that the average Briton lived a quality of life much closer to the average Eastern European. You know, the average, I don't want to say as, you know, go as far as say, I don't know, Moldova or Romania, but, you know, for sure Poland, and perhaps a little bit poorer than that as well. And this would have a huge effect on Britain. And yet we seem to be remarkably blasé about the City of London's position. For instance, we essentially created competitors for the City of London in the maritime insurance industry when we blocked out Russian oil shipping. Because, of course, insurance isn't, insurance of shipping isn't the most difficult thing to do. You kind of need capital to put behind it and a bit of know-how, but it's not, it's not the most complicated thing in the world. And of course, other places started insuring and providing that, and it gave them a guaranteed customer base. Equally, we're now talking about confiscating Russian assets and handing them over to Ukraine. That inevitably is going to lead, it's not going to lead to collapse, like every single foreign investor isn't just going to go, oh, well, that's it, we've got no confidence in London anymore, we'll, withdraw all of our capital in case at some stage in the future it's confiscated too. No, but it might lead those countries, such as China, Saudi Arabia, other Middle Eastern countries, for example, who are really big investors in the City of London in terms of the capital they put through it, it might lead countries like that, or investors or funds or high net worth individuals in countries like that, to add a political risk premium when they're calculating the return on capital they expect when they invest in London. What does that mean? Well, it essentially means they'll want a little bit more profit in exchange for doing business in London. That will in itself reduce the competitiveness of the City of London. You get this kind of constant erosion of the competitiveness. Eventually it's going to kind of reach a critical mass, and it's going to lose some of the synergistic effects that it had too. So I think this is very concerning. I would personally love if the UK economy was rebalanced, but from the City of London more toward the region, so we had a better balance. But the way to do it is not by collapsing the City of London. The way to do it is by actually building industry in the rest of the country. So, you know, I do think that this is, you know, really important to look at, not just for the City of London's position in the world, but for Britain's as well.
I mean, on the insurance thing, I do remember a far off time, probably about 18, not even maybe a year ago, when people were actually arguing with me on Twitter that like the Russians and the Indians couldn't set up insurance companies, which is a type of financial product that's been around for, I don't know, you could probably find some medieval insurance style arrangements, but certainly for the past few hundred years, insurance arrangements have been in place. So I thought that was quite funny. And I think it speaks to, frankly, a hubris, actually. Not only are people unwilling to look seriously at the British economic model, but they're just overconfident, you know, in the importance of the City of London, and they don't see that it can actually have these kind of fragilities. I just add two things to that. The first one is that, yes, as you say, a significant fall in living standards due to the current account having to close, which would manifest itself effectively as another decline in the sterling, which we've seen obviously two. We saw one after 2008, I think it was about 20%, and one after the Brexit vote, which was, I think, 15 to 20% again. And every time this happens, it never recovers. Import prices go up and you see real wages are eroded. Real wages have been effectively flat, I think, since 2008. In Britain. So that's how you actually physically see the falling living standards coming through. Now, as you say, you know, a substantial fall in living standards due to a closing of the trade deficit. I haven't run the numbers on it, but my sense will be it would be significant. You know, you could be talking about, I don't know, anywhere from 10 to 20% maybe of your real wages wiped out by a full closing. And of course, maybe there won't be a full closing, but a partial closing. Okay, all these would be details. But as you say, it could render at least parts of the country quite, not poor, but quite, you know, not very high up on the per capita income scale. And as you say, maybe Poland wouldn't be a terrible example. The only thing I'd add to that is that parts of the country are actually very, very poor anyway. I mean, parts of this, you might call it Polonization, if you want, have actually happened. If you've ever traveled around the country, especially in the north, of course, you probably have even more than I have because you're from the north. But I have actually ventured outside of London, and I've seen some parts of the country, and I've actually been shocked by the levels of, not quite poverty, but, you know, grey area. And I'm not talking about you see a couple of people who are poor. I'm talking about whole towns are just they have really, really low standards of living. And it's obvious when you look at them. Now, obviously, that would get worse and would drag the average down. And that's what, you know, where you might be saying, oh, it could look more like Poland or something. But the other interesting component is that all the people who are living high on the hog in London currently, whether they be directly working in finance or in the adjacent industry, legal services, these kind of things, there wouldn't be as many opportunities anymore. These people inside the London bubble, who've been effectively ignoring the decline that's been taking place in other parts of the country, would start to see that decline come back to grab them. And I think that would really shake the London bubble and the leadership class. And it would make them take much more seriously the economic problems that the country has. Because part of the reason, the hubris and so on that I referred to earlier, is because even if you look at the economic statistics and you go, geez, things are not great here, or even if you travel outside the London and some of the nicer places in the southeast and you see the economic effects of this, which are, you can tell, the data's not lying to me, even if you see all this, you still then drive back to London or down in Surrey somewhere where you have a nice house and you work in finance and everything's okay. Well, if what I'm talking about happens, that bubble in London is going to burst.